so glad to be together today. We just had a phenomenal, fascinating conversation with Dr. Cobb next door, and a lot of friends are coming in from there. Thank you for your presence here today. I'm so excited to continue this conversation. This is content that last week was the book, kind of the introduction and kind of getting you started into reading. And this thing is taking a step forward. So I am super pumped to hear where he's going to go with this. So without further ado, would you welcome Dr. John Cobb?
Well, some of you may not have been here last week, so I'll just very quickly say my focus last week was on talking about the word that Jesus used when Jesus was talking to God or about God, and that was the word Abba. And Abba is the only word in the language he was speaking, but Jesus took the characteristics of Abba very seriously and therefore put an emphasis where it has otherwise been lacking. And rather than thinking of God as the controller of all things, almighty, omnipotent, come here, yeah, having that kind of power to make things happen, we think instead of God as like the father of a young child who, in any healthy, normal situation, loves the child, wants the best for the child, is not judging the child, but will be working with the child, helping the child grow and become free, and hopefully a loving being. Now, I want today to put the focus on what this kind of thinking about God means for us. And the word that I use centrally in this respect, although it's only one of many that can be meaningfully used, is the idea of calling. In Jesus' relationship to Abba, felt called. Of course, Jesus loved Abba and was committed to serving Abba. And we, if we love God, love Abba, our Abba, and want to serve, we will need guidance. And I believe that the calling of God is something each of us needs to figure out for ourselves. But I think that we can say some general things about it that would apply to all of us. Now, I simply, in terms of locating God in our own experience, and that's where we need to find God, I like the expression, the call forward. I think in every moment, God is working in us to get us to act in that way, think in that way, feel in that way, that is best in that instance. And we often feel a little tension between what we actually do and what we recognize would have been a little better to do in that moment. The New Testament term is missing the mark, amatia. And we all, I think, know what it means to miss the mark, but then at other times, we may really be in the flow. But God may be shaping our lives. And those are joyful and creative periods. Now, my view of Jesus' calling, and that is what Jesus discerned as his mission, was about the people of Israel. That is, the Jewish people of his day. And remember that the Roman Empire was in control of Israel. And for Jews to serve the emperor was not acceptable. That doesn't mean you had to disobey the emperor, but the emperor could not be the one who controlled all the shots, because God was the one should serve. And the God of Israel was very different from the emperor of Rome. The Romans had more trouble with Jews than with any other people. And even in Jesus' youth, there was a rebellion against Rome, and he must have seen lots of people being crucified because the Romans, of course, successfully put it down. So one response of one who really believed in God and wanted to serve God was to throw off the Roman rule. And the Jews of his day remembered that not very long ago, I mean a couple of centuries, but within historical memory, the Jews had had a successful rebellion against an outside ruler and had had a period of independence. So you can understand why this was always on people's minds. Then there was this expectation of a Messiah. And the Messiah was one who was going to come and fulfill God's purposes in the world, and specifically in Israel. And they thought when the Messiah came, I mean, there were many ideas about the Messiah, but they were often closely related to freeing them again from an external rule. So that was one possible future that one could see, but Jesus did not believe that God would intervene and protect them from the might of the Roman Empire. And so he foresaw that that would be a calamity. Well, the other alternative was the one that the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem had adopted. That is compromise. Get as many privileges for the Jews as you can. So they were able to keep a temple, and they kept the statue of Caesar out of the temple. That was a concession to the Jews that they didn't make very often to other people. And they were able to give the Jews some opportunity of worshiping God. And these were the most prestigious people, the ones connected with the temple and the government. So a compromise with Rome was the second possibility. Well, Jesus was very much opposed to compromising. He was not that kind of a person, but he was also very much opposed to another military revolt. So he wanted to offer to the Jews a third way. And that third way was that they really become totally devoted to God. And he said, that is now possible. And if we become truly devoted to God, then we won't take up arms. That's not what God wants of us. We won't compromise with Rome. Come follow me. Okay, so what was Jesus' message? Repent. For the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Repent means just change the way you think. Really transform yourself into something very different. Now that was, of course, also very much John the Baptist. Well, I don't want to go into any more detail, but obviously Jesus did not succeed in getting enough Jews to follow the third way, to prevent the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile of all the people that he, I think, foresaw as being the result of their military revolts against Rome. Well, I'm saying all this to say, of course, I'm speculating. I don't really know exactly how Jesus was thinking, but I think the facts of his career fit this kind of image. Now, I'm going through all that because our real primary focus and concern today is what does all this mean for us? If we believe that we need to be totally devoted to God, what are we called to do? Now, we live in a time when the destruction that we are leading, that our behavior is leading us into, is global rather than simply one people. What does it mean to serve God, to love God with all of our hearts, minds, and soul, and our neighbor as ourselves, in a time when we know we are destroying the habitability of our planet. Well, to me, the model of Jesus is very important for us to reflect on today. I think we are called to bring about what we have called an ecological civilization. You can just say a sustainable society. There are many terms you can use. The one most promising movement that exists in the world today is that of the Pope. And he talks about an integral ecology. I don't care about the label, you understand. But I'm saying, I think we are called today to work for, I'm going to use the term I like the best, an ecological civilization. And that is being faithful to the God Jesus addressed. Now, the fact that Jesus was not successful doesn't mean that Jesus' actions aiming toward this were ineffective. Jesus called on people to join communities. Remember, he says to some people, come follow me. And there was a group of people who were following him, who shared everything in common, and who had a meal that was open to everybody, and who continued in this practice after Jesus' death and resurrection. And indeed, communities of this kind grew up in many places. And I think if we are seriously reflecting about what we can do, that we need to be doing everything we can to change the whole global system, but we can't do a whole lot about that. We can do some things. But mainly what we can do is to strengthen our human communities that of people who will support each other in the effort to change the wider system. And I believe that very likely what can survive the calamities that I fear are coming upon us will be communities of people. Remnants was a term they used in relationship to Israel. I would love to think that our churches were the communities that had a chance to make a contribution to the whole, to reduce the catastrophe, to survive calamities, and some congregations may be there. And I am delighted when I see healthy congregations that are really concerned not just about themselves, but about the world and about the needs to respond to these, to the global crises. But there are other ways in which communities are coming into being. And I do not believe that the only way of being faithful to Jesus is to work in the church. Or it may be that working in the church, I've just been in a meeting with a group who are not engaged in what in the past we have thought of as normal church life, but they becoming an ecclesia, maybe more like the early church than what the rest of us are doing. So we need to be very free about what the communities will be. But that if we really call on people to be truly devoted to God and to the God of Jesus in this day, communities will be needed to to do that. People, this individualism is not possible. When you're living in crisis, you need other people to be supporting you. If you want to serve God wholeheartedly, you need to have other people who are also wanting to serve God wholeheartedly, who you can think with and work with. I'm a Methodist. This is a Methodist church. I'm going to brag about Methodism. Okay. John Wesley was a servant of the Church of England, but the way he served the Church of England was by creating whole new kinds of communities that met the needs of people whose needs were not being met in the established church of his time. And these people really shared with each other deeply in their mutual quest to become better servants of God. I think what Wesley created was more like what Paul created than any other particular example in history. But now his very success, I mean, you know, these things are what happens at one particular historical point and not another. The one thing he was most afraid of was that his followers would become middle class. The poor can give themselves wholly. They don't have anything to block them. But you don't become middle class unless you get a few possessions and care a little bit about your security for the rest of your life and so forth and so on. I think we need to take all that into account. I'm not saying that all of us should cease being middle class. We need to find out what kinds of communities are possible for middle-class people that would really direct their collective energies and interests in a way that can survive through all kinds of calamities and disasters that the next generation are now inevitably going to face. I have myself been extremely fortunate. I live now in a retirement community that is a real community. I think that the city of Claremont has some real characteristics of being a community. That is, that people have feel keenly the importance of doing things together and doing things together that care out, that are helpful for all the people. But there's a huge difference between what a city the size of Claremont can be as a community and what a retirement community can be. I think the Claremont United Methodist Church is a healthy community. I think the School of Theology that I was part of for 32 years was a healthy community. So I believe healthy communities exist, and some of them have a real concern to serve God in a way that will reduce the suffering of human beings. And that's what we can all commit ourselves to doing. Now, what else can we say about what Jesus thought were the main obstacles, and what could be done, and what was the most important thing to happen? One of the things that we can be most confident of is that really comes from Jesus, is the Lord's Prayer. Now, if you think about what we ask for in the Lord's Prayer, there are two main things. We ask for our daily bread. And remember, we ask for our daily bread. This is not I'm asking for my daily bread. And the we is indefinitely extended. So we are committed when we pray the Lord's Prayer seriously to work to meet the basic needs of everybody. And that's, of course, we might not use bread as a comprehensive term for basic needs, but that's surely what Jesus is referring to. And the other thing that Jesus speaks of, and we Methodists, I was bragging about us a little while ago, unfortunately, in this respect, we did not do as well as the Calvinists. We ask that our trespasses be forgiven. But Jesus wanted us to ask that our debts be forgiven. And he made the point that our debts will be forgiven only as we forgive debts. He was talking economics. And we know that because there's a whole history of the issue of debts. And I think I want to explain that to you a little bit, because we're not going to get through the problems that lie ahead unless we deal with fundamental economic issues in a different way from the way we've been dealing with them. Now, in the ancient world, as in the modern world, there was always a tendency for a few people to acquire more money and other people to become indebted to them. And in the ancient world, when you had already given your property, the next thing you gave was yourself. You remember in the story of Joseph in Egypt, Joseph is advising the Pharaoh. And what he advises the Pharaoh to do is to store up a lot of food so that when the people of the country, because of famines, can't get enough to eat, they will come and finally they'll sell themselves to you. And you'll be, everyone in Egypt will be your slave. Well, whether that happened in Egypt just the way that story says, or I don't know, but it happened frequently in ancient countries that a few people became the slaveholders and the rest were slaves. Now, a king who ruled a country where most of the people were slaves had a hard time getting a good army. Slaves don't care that much to fight in order to defend their masters. And so, in order to have this ability to defend themselves against their enemies, or perhaps sometimes to conquer their enemies, they would declare a jubilee. And all the slaves got back their property and became farm owners again. And then the king could raise a good strong army of people who really had something to fight for. So in Leviticus we find that these same ideas of overcoming the problems that come from concentrating wealth in a very few hands were advocated, and these were rules. That we don't know how often in Israel they actually had a jubilee. It's a very interesting question. I think they probably did have some. And we know other countries did, so there's no reason to think Israel would not have done that. But the Lord's Prayer is a prayer for jubilee. Cancel all debts. Now, I'm not saying that all of it, we should be now working to get the government to just tomorrow cancel all debts. I mean, that's kind of silly. But it does mean that we really, if we're serious about this, we really should think of how to change an economic system that is based on debt. And ours is based on debt. And as all societies that have been based on debt, ours is concentrating more and more wealth in fewer and fewer hands. And there's no sign of this process ending anytime soon. Now, there are some people who are doing very serious thinking about how to have a different kind of monetary and financial system. And I think if we take Jesus seriously, we need to think about these alternatives and not suppose that there is no alternative, which is the language that's often used about the global economic system. This is both a national issue and a global issue. So my view is, if we take Jesus seriously, his thinking about God, his understanding of what God was calling him to do, his understanding of what we need to do, we will work on developing communities that are not based on the debt system. It would be very helpful if we could develop nations that were not based on the debt system. Economically, I think if we had a society not based on the debt system, that the pressures we would put on our environment would be greatly reduced. And of course, then we need to work directly on reducing. In Jesus' day, the issue of relating the relationship to the natural world was didn't have the importance it has today. So Jesus says, is impressed by the way God deals with the natural world and so forth. He doesn't ignore it, but there's nothing in the Lord's Prayer specifically about healing our alienation from the natural world. I would add that to the list of things. If we think God is the God of everything, then our regarding the natural world is there simply for our exploitation is not, for me, does not seem to fit an understanding of God as Abba and of my calling to serve that God with all of my heart and my being. I think I'll stop here and see if you have questions or comments. Yes.
It was a pleasure to hear you speak this morning. I lived in Claremont for 29 years, know the community, the school very, very well. So I know what you're talking about in terms of that kind of environment. But I'm somewhat puzzled by the way you use the term ecological civilization.
Okay.
Now, are we talking about tree huggers? Or are you using it in a much more global way when you're using ecological civilization?
Well, first, I'm very consciously introducing the word civilization.
Yes.
Okay. So there's a great deal, I mean, If you look over the whole history, there are those who say once civilization was established, we were on the road to self-destruction. Okay.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Well, civilization, the rise of civilization was not a nice thing. Civilization meant cities. Cities were based on slavery and armies. Up until then, there were no warfare. I mean, there was fighting between tribes. I don't mean there was everybody was nice to everybody, but empire, but conquest, that all came about with civilization. The status of women was greatly lowered and reduced by civilization. But civilization inherently is a kind of alienation from the natural world. More people live in an artificial world, and the people who are still living out there are condescended to, or they look to. Most people are slaves. So civilization is not a kind of wonderful, nice thing that was a great improvement to what went on before. Nevertheless, it achieved some very wonderful things. One of the things that civilization achieved was a greatly increased population. If we try now to do away with civilization, most of us would have to die. So I think it's very important that we seek a different civilization. The present civilization is unsustainable. When I realized that, I said, well, this is the most important question that we face. If it's unsustainable, that means we're going to die. I mean humanity. I don't mean just that we will individually die. We're collectively heading for massive death. So to have a civilization that is sustainable is the minimum. I prefer to use the word ecological because the only way we'll have a sustainable civilization is if we develop a relationship to the natural world and to each other of mutual dependence and mutual support. And the word ecological has those connotations to me. But the language is not important. The important thing is our civilization needs deeply to change so that we do not every day, right now, every day, we make the future worse. That to continue to participate in that with no protest or no resistance is not what God calls us to. Yes.
Are you suggesting then that Revelation was actually talking about this?
The book of Revelation.
Yeah, and Armageddon. Is that the ultimate?
Well, of course, I don't think the author of that book had any notion what was going to happen in the third millennium. So I don't think I would say he's thinking of that. But certainly, for a long, long time, people have thought of the ending of things. And I'm not encouraging the ending of things. I don't want us to look at this.
But you're saying it's possible the way we're going.
The way we're going, we're heading for it. But I think Jesus saw that Israel was heading for self-destruction, and he did what he could. The Christian community in Jerusalem left Jerusalem rather than participate in the fight against the Romans, and it survived. I'm not trying to lift that up as extremely noble. I'm just saying we've got to find another way. I think that the two people who have been dramatically successful by seriously following Jesus in recent times are Gandhi and King. And I think that's very significant, that if we want to be serious disciples of Jesus, no violence. We need to love our enemies. And that ain't easy, but that's Jesus, very distinctive feature of Jesus' teaching. So we need to do everything we can to save our enemies as well as ourselves.
But when your enemies are sworn to your destruction.
Well,
can you repeat what she said?
She said, but when your enemies are sworn to your destruction. I don't know that there are any such enemies right now, but of course it becomes harder if such enemies should develop.
Yeah. And along that line, how do nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear war fit into ecological civilization? How do we prevent it?
Again,
there are nuts in the world that would like to destroy us with their nukes.
If you really want to know, I think the greatest threat to the world is in Washington, D.C. And we do have some responsibility for that. Much more difficult for us to have an effect upon North Korean foreign policy than there is to have an effect upon...
But North Korea could hit us.
North Korea is developing that, but again, I don't want to get off too far on this, but if you ask why has North Korea developed these weapons, it's because otherwise we would have taken it over. There are parts of the world people will rather die fighting for their freedom than simply surrendering. And I'm not saying they're right. Probably be better off if they would all surrender to us. But I don't think we should look at them as the villains if it's our threat to them that is causing them to behave that way. So I think the American Empire has many of the same characteristics as the Roman Empire. And they're not all bad, don't misunderstand. A lot of people over the history of the West have looked back to the Roman Empire as the great day, the peace, the Roman peace. But that's not the way the Bible looks at it. And I don't think the Bible is that a biblical Christian will look at the American Empire any more favorably than at the Roman Empire or at the British Empire. You understand, I'm not trying to pick out, but right now, the American Empire is the global empire. There's no question. We have no competition. And we won't brook any competition. So, yes, if we get involved in war, real war, that's probably the end. Yes.
So what I'm hearing you say is the American Empire has taken our economy and our understanding and taken that as what is Christian and what is godly, when in fact we have to reframe what is actually God's economy and God's community. I'm trying to bring us back into that understanding, not that it's just an American understanding of imperialism.
I think that in terms of what I especially emphasized last time and this time, Jesus teaches us that the power that we should be interested in, the power that God has, and the power that God wants us to work with God, is the power of empowering, the power of liberating, the power of guiding, the power of saving, not the power of destroying. Empires are based on the power to destroy. So I don't think that any effort by one people to control everybody else can ever legitimately be thought of as an expression of Jesus' understanding of God. And so anytime anybody says, oh, our empire is a Christian empire, and we want everybody to be part of it because it's Christian, I don't think that has much to do with Jesus. Yes?
Last week you talked about theology, religion, losing its voice at the table in academia.
Yes.
And I was very interested in hearing more about that.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, if we just think about education in this country in the last, I mean, we can go back a long way, but just when I was coming along, when you thought of higher education, you thought of a liberal arts college. Now, there are still liberal arts colleges, but the vast majority of people who continue their education after high school now go to state universities or community colleges or universities in the broad sense. Now, in my view, these universities adopted the wrong assumptions. Okay. One of the wrong assumptions is that education should be value-free. Now, liberal arts colleges were never value-free. If you just get, you know, you can just study catalogs if you want. Most of the liberal arts colleges were established by the church. Churches, I don't think. And most of them, they said that their purpose was to educate people in such a way they could understand their cultural heritage and participate in shaping it and contribute that to the future. It was thought that if you wanted to be an effective leader in society, you needed a liberal arts education. But if you look at the university curricula or community college catalogs, almost entirely meant preparing you for a better job. Now, I don't mean to say jobs are not important, but to think of education as primarily job-oriented is, I think, a considerable come-down from thinking the function of education is to produce well-rounded human beings who are deeply committed to the wider community and know how to help it. So it's this shift by itself is a big part of what I'm concerned about. Universities wouldn't have to be that way. Medieval universities were the place where liberal arts got established. And our liberal arts colleges still reflected the Christian oranges of the of that university. Okay, I think that the other term that is now used by the best universities is the term research. So you will find that the university understands itself, I mean, the best universities wouldn't understand themselves as job training. They would understand themselves as preparing people to do research. Value-free research university, that's what Harvard or Yale or Princeton and all the rest will call themselves. Okay, I'm just describing, I don't think I'm, if you think I'm not being accurate, you can correct me later, but now, my view is that it's fine to prepare some people to do research, but the idea that research is all society needs for leadership, it's just wrong. And value-free research has led to creating academic disciplines that are, in terms of the whole scope of things, very narrow, and they become almost self-enclosed, so that people who work in one academic discipline really don't understand the categories that are being used in another academic discipline. So research is not research in gaining a wider understanding of the nature of things, what our society most needs, how we could help our society to avoid destroying itself. Very hard to find any research along those lines in any university. Even if it's a department of ecology, that has become a very specialized discussion of very limited things and so forth. So I think that our educational system is not directed to what an educational system should be directed toward. It doesn't mean there are not a lot of information you can get in. The amount of information that is being dished out every day is just amazing, fascinating, wonderful. But when you are on a sinking ship, I'm not sure that information is very helpful. And when you teach everybody that values are not important, that does not reduce the chances of the ship sinking. I think we urgently need, that's why I consider the worship of Abba extremely important. If you just say the worship of God, that could be an omnipotent deity, and that worshiping an omnipotent deity, I think, can do a lot of harm. But I think that worshiping Abba can lead us to care a great deal about the values, great deal of concern, and then if we can shape our education from that, we'd still have a chance. Yes?
Abba being a caring, almost motherly kind of God. What are your thoughts on intervention? If we are headed on a really bad
path, yes,
and there is this caring God, where's the intervention come? Sometimes I think of it as like the prime directive in Star Trek, where if you don't interfere, you let them go down the line.
Uh-huh.
What are your thoughts on intervention?
Well, if intervention means protest and trying to reform things and proposing better ideas, then I'm 100% for intervention. Oh, God's intervention. I think the notion of God, if you're expecting God to intervene, you're going to be very disappointed. No. I think we need to intervene in all kinds of ways. But I think there are good forms of intervention and bad forms of intervention. And the way a loving parent intervenes in the life of a child is a better model of thinking of intervention than taking up arms and trying to destroy something. Or, yes, sir.
Why then do we pray to God asking for things?
Well, I think that prayer can be very important, and I think if we see what it is, I mean, in my experience in the church, a high percentage of prayers are for the healing of the sick. And I don't think that's empty. I think that if you meditate, you can also send out good vibes. I'm trying to use language, and you understand these are very complicated topics to deal with very quickly. But I think we affect each other in all kinds of ways, and that praying for somebody will be beneficial. But I also think God is already at work in that person's body, and is working in a healing direction. And I believe God can be more effective in working in that person's body if a lot of people are around thinking about that person, hoping for the good. Prayer is a very good form, good way to express that. But if you just say, I'm praying to God to make peace in the world, I think you're wasting your time. Unless that prayer makes you work harder for peace. I don't think God's going to intervene.
You can ask for guidance, but not ask for
peace. We can guidance we can ask for, and we can try to make ourselves more useful to God. And then that actually helps God. If you ask God to do what God doesn't want to do, I think that's kind of silly. If you try to make yourself a channel for God to do what God already wants to do, I think that can be very helpful for you and helpful for God and helpful for the world. Yes?
In World War II, or prior to World War II, would you have been a pacifist?
Well, I was a soldier in World War II, so I...
Wasn't that war for good?
Until fairly recently, I thought maybe I had been in the just war. I'm not nearly as sure of that now. But I don't want to. I mean, I don't want us to get involved in detailed discussion about what the options were. But it's when you really know all the shenanigans that go on and understand what all the options actually were, I doubt that the war was the best solution to the problem. Yeah. Well, I assure you, I don't say that casually. I mean, it was important to me to feel all right about that one. But certainly no war since then has been a just war by any serious discussion. Yes. Yes.
That the people of Israel had expected and anticipated a Messiah, which would have been this intervention. And then when Jesus came to the earth, it wasn't the intervention they anticipated. So if we were to have an intervention today, it wouldn't be the sort of intervention we anticipated.
That's right. Yes. Well, I think Jesus was certainly trying to intervene in the direction that Jewish society was headed. But his effort to intervene, lots of different expectations, but many people did expect a kind of military, monarchical intervention, and Jesus was calling people to truly subordinate their private and individual interests to the needs of the whole people, and some responded, and we wouldn't be Christians today if that hadn't happened. But the Jews lost their homeland for a long time.
The phrase that keeps jumping for me as I hear you today is, love your enemies and pray for your enemies.
Yes.
I don't think we get it.
No, that's why I picked on Gandhi and King, because they... See, I don't think you can really get the idea of loving your enemies from any source except Jesus. I don't want to say that too strongly, Buddhists in a way, but it's anyway, there's a distinctive feature of what Jesus said. And Christians have not paid a lot of attention. It was interesting that a Hindu was the first one to take Jesus seriously. But it worked. That's the astonishing thing. I don't mean that it will always work. I think you could try to organize. I think there have been other efforts to organize along the lines of Gandhi that did not work out. So I'm not trying to speak of a guarantee. But it would still be awfully good if people in the church would take Jesus seriously. It would be a huge improvement over well.
Yes.
Yeah. Excuse me? Oh, yes, sir.
If God is all-knowing, and what is it that keeps the God who is all-knowing and all-powerful?
No, God. You see, the whole point of Abba is God is not all-powerful. God doesn't have controlling power. God has created power, but no controlling power.
Where does that appear?
Well, just read the New Testament. And I really think if you would pay close attention to what Jesus says and what Paul says, it doesn't have anything to do with being almighty.
No, Jesus certainly did not. I'm not sure about what Paul said. I don't remember.
I don't think either. I'm not saying you won't find any hints in that direction. You know, a lot of people were involved in producing our New Testament. And there's one reason I've heard people who can make some awfully good things out of the book of Revelation. It's awfully easy to read that book as expressing the activity of a controlling God. So I'm not too fond of that book.
Yeah. How is the relationship of some of the miracles, like raising the dead
and
so on? Is he doing that in the power of God or what?
Yeah. If we talk about, I think one of the things we can be very sure about is that Jesus did remarkable healings. Yeah, so I'm not questioning that at all. Sometimes the healing is attributed to Jesus. Sometimes it's attributed to God. Sometimes it's attributed to the faith of the person who is healed. Now, my view is Jesus played a role, God played a role, the person who was healed played a role. You can call them miracles. The Roman Catholic Church calls them miracles when they happen now, and you can't get yourself declared a saint unless some miracles take place. I think that we were talking before about praying for healing. I think that there is such healing. Now, there are a few extreme instances. For example, Lazarus is the most extreme. They make a point of his body already stinking and all of that. Of course, you only read about that in the latest of the Gospels. It seems to me an event of that astonishing character would have been known by Paul, or by Matthew or Mark or Luke. So simply my judgment of historical fact, I would not include that among the historical facts. But I'm in no position to make any kind of final judgment. It's also true with the resurrection appearances. Paul, we know a little bit about the appearance to Paul, and this is the only time you get a first-hand account. I think it was an amazing event, but not a miracle of the extreme sort that.
Well, I guess my point was that maybe that's leading us astray a little.
I think that the the image of supernatural interventions has been very unfortunate. I think there's much less of it in the Bible than people think there is, but it does occur. In my book, I talk about the Exodus story and the crossing of the Red Sea. And you find side by side two pictures. One of them, an east wind blows, and the water is pushed off enough that people on foot can get across. Then afterwards, the water comes back. And meanwhile, it's so muddy that the wheels, you know, it's I'm not saying that God has nothing to do with it. I'm just saying it's not the kind of thing that Cecil B. DeMille. But he got the other explanation. The story was retold in a way that the water stood on both sides as the people walked through. Okay. I think that some people like to embellish these things a little bit. And so if you build your faith on the embellishments rather than on the basic story, I think you'll be disappointed that they don't give you a good idea of what's likely to happen.
Well, maybe some of the writers were Cecil B. DeMille's.
Well, you see, I think miracles are amazing events in which God's presence is markedly visible to us. And that's sort of what was meant by miracle. But once you get a transcendent God up there who only from time to time acts in the world, then you like to embellish these things and make them more and more impossible without a radically supernatural event.
It certainly isn't new for the New Testament because it happens over and over again in the Old Testament.
It happened. Well, I was using an example from the Old Testament in the Exodus story, which can be very plausible, or you can turn it into an incredible thing. Yeah. Excuse me, somebody?
I was amused this morning by a story on NPR that I thought, I see Chris is over there trying to pull us to a conclusion. You're talking about the ecological civilization, and we're talking about intervention. So on NPR this morning, breaking news from Sweden, that there's a legislation going before their process for legislation to have tax benefits for those who repair their furniture and appliances as opposed to throwing them out.
Uh-huh.
And I was just struck with how far we've gone in terms of being a consumerist. Yeah. Society/world, that to repair our belongings, including clothing, we now would need tax incentives, including the lower paid to do it. So I just thought you might
I really want to announce something. I wish I could be very specific about it, but UCLA is committing itself to zero waste. And Pando Populous, some of you know that's a program that grew out of the conference that we had, Ignacio Schutt, is responsible for putting on the event in which this whole process is going to begin. And since you folks live not too far away, keep your eyes on the newspaper. I think it may be the end of this month.
So they're going completely paperless and...
No. Zero waste means you still use these things.
But they're going to recycle everything they touch.
I don't think they'll ever get to zero waste. But if they got to 10%, that would be a tremendous gain over where they are now. Zero waste is a kind of absolute goal that I do understand a few places have gotten, but it's very expensive to get there, which makes me think probably using up a lot of other resources in order to
But I went to a conference this past week at a church in Encino that has
church, gotten to zero waste.
They're not quite there, but they put solar panels on the roof. Oh. They have a water catch system, and a church has taken this on themselves to say, hey, we're going to see our community move through this. And not only that, the community bought into the individuals within it are trying to kind of race towards that. I think they're given indulgences or something to make it. So we have milked John. I just wanted to recognize a couple. Thank you, Dr. Scott Barchi's been here. If you want to sometimes see what things you can do to a home, they're going to go for a tour today. But Dr. Barchi has done an incredible job of building a home that is ecologically positive. Not only is it not taking a toll on the environment, it's building back to it. It's amazing pictures and stories of what he's done. And
we've lived there 14 years, and we haven't spent a penny to heat it or to cool it. Right now, our solar panels are powering the neighborhood.
Oh my God.
And although I do not have much respect, with any apologies to anybody here, for the administration of SCE, I think they talk on both sides as well. I'm glad to report to you that 2 years ago, I got $88 back for the extra power. I paid nothing to them, except they insist I have to pay them $1.50 a month for them to send me an invoice that says I don't owe them anything. The thing of it is, it can be done, and there's a lot of incentives now for doing it.
Neighborhood is the
hot water by the sun. You just have to get set up to do it. And I can tell one more thing. At a time when homes, custom homes, were costing between $385 and $410 per square foot, I built this for $280.
Is that so? Wow.
For $280. It can be done.
Wow. Wow. Thank you.
And this is the kind of testimony that a church should be having a lot of.
It's a miracle.
It is a miracle. That's the way we should use that word, miracle.
Yes. May we say thank you to our esteemed leader. Thank you. Have a great week. This will be coming up on the internet next week. We'll post everything. If you want to share it with friends, that'd be phenomenal. Thank you.